Thank you, Hiro. Now, Professor Tanaka, this is the how many generations in genealogy of PhDs? I would say great, great, great grandkid of Enrico Fermi, because I come from lineage of Enrico Fermi. So thank you for inviting me. And I wanted to say that I am really impressed. I have never been to Toronto. I'm not impressed with your weather, by the way. I love you. 87 from Pasadena. But I'm really impressed. This is, I always heard, because I had very good colleagues and collaborators at CDF, Professor William Trischuk, Pierre Savard, and Pekas Nervo, who, when I was at CDF, they taught me a lot of the physics I learned in Hadron Colliders, and they were always extremely prolific and hard-nosed. They were difficult colleagues and collaborators, and now they are competitors. Because they are in the other experiment, the bigger, although we are the heavier one. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I was very also impressed with the students that I met at lunch. And I'm pretty sure that this is a subset of all of the graduate students who are working in all areas of physics. A very competitive and very strong crowd of young people who are actually, I am expecting them, homework for them is to solve the puzzles, because we've got a few of them. I will be talking about, I will be hopscotching a little bit on the field of particle physics. In the United States, the way we fund this field is in different frontiers. The energy frontier, that it is high-energy colliders based on accelerators. The intensity frontier, that it is both based on accelerators and observations, as in the case of the different experiments that observe neutrinos, for which we had the Nobel Prize, and here from this country, specifically, and the physics of neutrinos, for example, that Hiro is involved, and also the cosmic frontier, which is related with astroparticle physics and with cosmological observations. And the story will be that in all of these three different areas, there are connections and there are puzzles that are related to the type of physics we want to do, namely, understand how the universe works and the components of the universe. And as of recent, we didn't have even the Higgs, so we didn't understand electroweak symmetry breaking, so we discovered the Higgs. And one might think that we are in a better place. In my opinion, we're in a very puzzling place, and I will explain this a little bit in terms of the Higgs. The things to remember, the things to take home by the end of the talk is what are the Higgs connections specifically, if any, with dark matter, if we consider it to be a particle, and with neutrinos, the particles of the standard model that everything we predicted about was proven by experiment wrong, and perhaps about the evolution of the universe and the acceleration, the cosmic acceleration of the universe, which is also gravitational. Does it have to do something with particle physics? And also, one thing that we have to remember from this talk is that the Higgs is found. So whether we call it natural or unnatural, or whether we can compute it or not compute it, it's there. Therefore, it's natural, because we have discovered it. So any quivers that we have about corrections and other things that called the needs for completing the picture of the Higgs with other physics, it should be put again into question on how we make progress on that. But the Higgs is there, and so it's natural. It's not unnatural. So let me start by showing you the picture, which I like to show because, of course, Feynman was at Caltech. Of course, my students' parents who came from Colombia, they were ecstatically happy when they saw this big poster in my office because they thought it was Frank Sinatra, and they started singing, in fact. And in all what I say, including specifically also on how we do cosmology or on how we do large-scale structure today. Effective field theories are a big, big thing, and specifically quantum field theory, almost at all scales, is the language of particle physics and the language also of condensed matter physics with quasi-particles. So we are using this language, and one by the end of the day, with all the data that we have today, one can sit down and think if this is actually valid at all scales, yes or no. And when I say at all scales, I mean at the electroweak scale, we have it, we are calculating it, but at the Planck scale and intermediate scales, we are extrapolating or interpolating. The scales that are relevant for the physics, for the particle physics, experimental particle physics program today is the scale, the electroweak scale, which is the TEV scale, where we found the Higgs, the W, the Z. There's the scale of the neutrinos, which is a few orders of magnitude less. And then for the universe, it's the size of the universe, the Hubble scale or the Planck scale, if you want. And these are very, very many many orders of magnitude apart. And this is the so-called hierarchy problem, or the problem, so to speak, of why is the universe so big? Now, you probably have, as I mentioned earlier, you have a very strong particle physics division here with your faculty are extremely prolific, and you have heard probably from many of them, or you have gotten courses about the standard theory, which mathematically speaking, you can write it in a group theory, you can write it as U1 cross SU2 cross SU3. Probably a mathematician could make a picture in their mind of what that means in terms of states. We call this the electroweak sector. We call this the strong sector. This is quantum chromodynamics for all the hadron interactions. And this is electromagnetism and the weak nuclear forces. You see that we don't talk about gravity at all when we talk about the standard model of particle physics. And then we have some picture that looks kind of squared with all the particles. There's some classification and categorization of the particles. We have seen this many times. And it all looks somewhat orderly with the particular quantum numbers. And we had a theory, which was the theory of electroweak symmetry breaking in the standard model. In fact, this is the circle here is what is in your... Is the rendition in the poster that I gave you from the particle fever of all the modes that go around in the circle. If you know quantum field theory, you can see there the Higgs and its couplings to the different particles that are shown on the right side. Now, if we want to make it a little bit different, we talk about fermions that have spin 1/2 in this categorization, and bosons that have spin 1 up until the discovery of the Higgs that has no spin. It has spin, namely spin 0, and this is the first, we think, elementary that has spin 0. And then if we want to show them not in the square way, but in the spherical way, and put them in some sort of a scale for their masses, we see that the picture is kind of complex. There is some big difference in the masses, starting from the neutrinos all the way to the top. There is many orders of magnitude, and why these masses are different and why do we have all these families is something that we really don't know. And for the bosons, which have spin 1, we've got the gauge bosons, which is the photon, the W, and the Z. This goes in the U1 cross SU2, and then we have the gluons that goes into SU3, and these are the mediators of the forces, the electromagnetic, the electroweak force, and then QCD. Now, one of the big problems that we have in the consideration of all this picture of the universe at the most elementary scales, at the most elementary picture, is the matter-antimatter asymmetry. All things being equal in how we start and we make conditions for the universe, we should there's no particular reason that we would have excess of one versus the other. And if we did, we wouldn't have a universe because particles and matter and antimatter would annihilate. So the idea is that there was a tiny, tiny little difference in the early universe between matter and antimatter. And this is the reason why we ended up on a matter universe. And it doesn't matter what you call matter and what you call antimatter, one of the two. But the other, the one is the one that it is dominating, and we have a matter universe. For this was a point of a subject of experimental program in particle physics for over 30 years in the quark sector. And I think you had some colloquium the previous week where people were talking about CP violation in the quark sector. And this is basically the weirdness of quantum mechanics on how these quarks mix. And we have a description for them. There was also Nobel Prizes for all these physics. This is physics that my students say we lost the train by 30 years. But we have completed a program on this where we actually have an understanding of the mixing of the quarks and the oscillations of mesons in a very precise way. And the main point that we have concluded is that this is not the source of the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. Specifically, that was the picture of the theoretical picture, and the experimental picture is this. We have measured all the elements here that are basically showing you the strengths of the transitions of the different quarks, as was shown in the matrix, the Kabibo-Kobayashi-Moskawa matrix. All of these have been measured. By the way, there's nobody who tells you how to calculate this. These are parameters that we measure. It's not nothing that you can calculate. And the program has a multi-experimental program at in the US, in Japan, at CERN, in order to study this sector, including even as of now, looking for the topic that was presented to you last week on how you can, in the loops, how you can make precise measurements in this quark mixing, precise and CP violation, precise measurement of corrections that would come, or loop corrections that would come from heavy states, and therefore we say that this is a precision program that can measure TV scale physics and anomalies at the TV scale. So despite the fact, however, that we didn't find the source of CP violation to be enough on the quark sector, there is a huge program, and I should say that this institution has been participating in these experiments in Babar and also in the B physics at CDF with a very strong program. But we also have now a huge program in the world, international program in the world, on the lepton quantum mixing, and specifically on the neutrino quantum mixing. And this is the Pontecorvo Makinagawa Sakata matrix. You see that in the previous matrix we had all these being ones, and we had all those being very small numbers. Here this is even more complex. So the program of the neutrino program started over 50 years ago, and it's a very interesting story if you have time to read it. When people observed that there was an anomaly on how many neutrinos you were observing from the sun compared to the calculation, people thought that both the people who calculated it and the people who measured it were mistaken. And in fact, they were not. None of them was wrong. And there has been a program for neutrino oscillations, both atmospheric and solar, around the world and in the U.S. Specifically, the newest one. I will talk 1 second about the newest one, which is the LBNF program, the Long Baseline Facility program in the U.S. that in fact is foreseen to actually make this measurement on the delta CP, whether neutrinos are the source of the CP violation, a bigger source of CP violation, or the source of CP violation, and therefore understand matter-antimatter asymmetry from the neutrino sector. I think this is an extremely important program, and just so that I show you first the experiments here and second the theory, but this is the one unmeasured phase that is related to CP violation. All the other mixing angles have been measured. Now, just so that I say a few words about neutrinos and how these are very, very peculiar particles. And as I said earlier, for the most part, wherever people calculated and predicted for neutrinos, they were proven wrong by the experiment. So from the sun, you got a flavor. This is an electron flavor neutrino. And 8 minutes later, it appears on Earth in three flavors. So electron, muon, and tau. And one thing to say is that a neutrino of a particular, of a definite flavor, does not have a definite mass. But it has, it is a combination of the mass, what we call the mass eigenstates. And similarly, which are the new one, new two, new three. A neutrino of definite mass, so that would be a new one, does not have a definite flavor, because it is only in the mixing that you get the flavor. And so this is the perfect quantum interferometer, if you want. And the thing to understand here, to make a point of, is that we are talking about neutrinos coming from the sun all the way to the Earth and oscillating. And these are the mass eigenstates, and these are the flavor eigenstates. This is an electron neutrino, for example. This is a perfect quantum interferometer. And the program that we are using, both at Fermilab, in terms of sending neutrinos out very far away, is this because, which wasn't the case for the quarks, is because they oscillate, they need much more length before they oscillate. And so these are what we call long baseline. They have to go very long before they actually oscillate. And in fact, this is the program that exists already at Fermilab, and the program that they are building now in South Dakota. I wanted to show here, Hiro is a member of the Physics Advisory Committee, who is, based on his knowledge of neutrinos forever and the T2K, is advising the Fermilab director, who is next to him, this is why he's exactly next to the Fermilab director, on how to build this actual program. So I will move now to the high energy. This was a part of the intensity frontier and a part of the puzzle about neutrinos. And we will ask the question again, and this is a difficult question, have we connected the Higgs with neutrinos? Now that we know that neutrinos have mass, we have measured them, oscillate, and so on, how do we connect them? And this is another huge, big colloquium that people give on the nature of the mass of the neutrinos, which is a spectacular topic, because also, if the mass of the neutrinos was a little different, you, as it turns out, you wouldn't have the correct large-scale structure. So when the people who are doing the simulations for the universe are putting the different ingredients, neutrinos and dark matter being the most difficult of them, if you change those, then you don't get the large-scale structure that we observe. And I'm not going to talk about this, but I'm telling you this, and it's a very, very important point. Neutrinos are not just interesting because of the matter-antimatter asymmetry. They are interesting because you can do astrophysics observations, you can use them as an astronomy laboratory if you want, in the same way that you use LIGO, gravitational waves, as an astronomy telescope, in a sense, looking at the universe, the same way you can use a neutrino. So I'm moving to the very high energy collider, the highest energy collider that we have built ever, maybe forever, we'll see. So this is from I think this is from June, and you see here, this is two bottles of champagne, Atlas and CMS. CMS should be buying champagne to the accelerator people all the time because we didn't buy one for them for the Higgs discovery, and they hate us for that. But here you will see something that says 10 to the 34th thanks. And I mean, I'm not sure if it's thanks and the flame here, it means our detector is on fire. And the thanks is a little bit of a don't do this. Or if it is, I think it's really thanks from the point of view, really, because it has been a spectacular run for the LHC. The accelerator people have produced so much data that 10 to the 34 there is a measure of the instantaneous luminosity, which is how much data the accelerator people are producing when they collide the proton beams. So this number is a huge number. In fact, the three times this is the number for the high luminosity LHC, which is supposed to start in beyond 2020, and we have achieved this now. So the accelerator people are literally burning us. I don't know how to say this better, but of course this is a reason for celebration because we have more data than we actually expected from the LHC. Let me just go a little bit just to remind you what happened in the past 2 years. You have heard the last thing probably you have heard about the LHC, and you remember is that we discovered the Higgs. And then we shut down in 2015. We did recommissioning. We had a bunch of beam-related recommissioning to do. Electron cloud. These are UFOs, which are pretty much particles of dust, we think, that they go inside the beam from the beam pipe, and then they cause a beam dump. These are technical defects, if you want, that have to do with the materials of the beam pipe, both the electron cloud and those dust particles that were interrupting the run, and we needed to take particular action for this one. For example, we put something that it is called electron scrubbing beam. We put a beam that was not a colliding beam, but it was a beam that was sweeping around in order to get off this electron cloud and shield them. So we had to do a lot of acrobatics. When I say we, I mean the accelerator people, who are really, really fantastic. And they managed to have all these problems more or less solved. And we had to also change some of the electronics, the LHC-related electronics, which were not as radiation-hard as they should have been. And these were many thousand cards that had to change. So this was the recommissioning, and then we started collisions in 2016, and we had quite a few challenges that made the news. The whistle that was actually fried, a proton synchrotron main power supply that went down, and then the super proton synchrotron. The proton synchrotron and the SPS are getting the beam from 25 GV to 450 GV before they enter into the large tunnel. So one is like gear one, one is gear two, the LHC is gear three, and we have also pre-gears because we have injectors and Linux. So these were challenges, but not only we managed to recover, but we managed to be the accelerator people managed to be extremely extremely creative and squeeze the bunch, fill the bunches with a lot of protons and arrange the what we call the optics. The optics is how you put the magnets, essentially. The equivalent of optical lenses is magnetic lenses, how you do your electromagnetic fields so that the beams get squeezed in the point of the collision, and they managed to do it in such a way so that we actually exceed the expectation of how many collisions we get in the crossings. So the maximum luminosity, because of one triplet cooling limitation, was could not get above this 1.7 10 to the 34. So 1.7 10 to the 34, as I mentioned earlier, is high luminosity LHC type of numbers. Not exactly, but close, by a factor of 2 or so. And also, I just want to mention that if you remember from the technical specifications, we used to have interactions every 50 nanoseconds in the previous run, and now we have interactions every 25 nanoseconds. So crossings are every 25 nanoseconds. So you pack billions of protons and you in the train of the beam, and you collide them every 25 nanoseconds. You can imagine what this means in terms of triggering, getting the data that is good data. If you calculate it based on the cross-section, the total cross-section, and some sort of estimate of how big an event could be, our input rate is a petabyte per second. And it's something here to appreciate that the LHC is the biggest big data factory, which is also useful data, not just tweets or Facebook posts. That means that for all our students, postdocs, staff, professors, we actually have to be very aware of how our computing models and how our analysis and data and trigger operate. And we are kind of forced in the past few years to use all these artificial intelligence methods and deep learning and so on. And this is an area where within the high energy physics community, including the neutrinos, in fact, whenever you have some challenges that have to do with reconstruction, with pattern recognition, and you go to imaging and you figure out with the current computing architectures whether you can improve also your science. And I think this is an area in our field that it is booming right now, and the young people are extremely creative, and we see results that they are really very good. So now one thing that I want to say about the LHC is that this is stable beam, and up to July it was 67% of the time stable beam. This is unprecedented for a machine of this complexity. The LHC has performed in 2016 in an unprecedented way for a collider. I think my colleagues from CDF will remember that we were not getting these numbers back then. So this is really to their credit, to the LHC accelerator people credit. And now I want to show you a little bit the history of the data. We got data in 2000. This is the data from 2011, 2012. We got a few inverse femtobarn, two or three, in 2015. And this is the 2016 run. And you can see just from the slope that this is really an unbelievable run. Of course, the accelerator cannot go that way. And here there's a graph of how many. This is the few inverse femtobarn on 2015. And then we think about 35 on 2016. We exceeded that. I will show you got 40 integrated luminosity. And then 40 and 40 in the next 2 years, by which time we will have another shutdown. And this will be the largest data set of the highest energy hadron collision data ever, that will have also the largest number of Higgses, where we can do measurements, precision measurements even, discovery measurements on rare decays in the Higgs sector, which will be extremely useful for our physics. So this is 2 days ago, in fact. So the run was done on the 26th of this month. And here Pierre complained that CMS got a little more luminosity than Atlas, but in the previous run, Atlas got a little more luminosity than CMS. Overall, we are squared. And the results from this data will be shown in Morion 2017. So now, I will change gears now and talk a little bit about the Higgs and beyond, what I mean by the Higgs and beyond. By the way, the Higgs and beyond means really a shot in the dark at this particular moment. The Higgs and beyond would not be a shot in the dark if we have found supersymmetry already. And the reason why I'm saying this is because the story we had, based on quantum field theory and our understanding of quantum mechanics, is that we will find the Higgs, and immediately after that, we will find what is the quantum, who is protecting the Higgs from quantum corrections to the mass of the Higgs. And we had a fantastically beautiful story. I speak like Trump. You see, I watch too much CNN. We had a very precise and very well-calculated story about what we need in the quantum, in the corrections of the Higgs, and that was supersymmetry. And this is this. We expected that supersymmetry would be there even before the Higgs. When I was giving colloquium in 2008, before we started, my prediction, my expectation, and based on all the training that I got in physics, is that we will find SUSY before supersymmetric particles, namely heavy degrees of freedom that stabilize, that solve the hierarchy problem and stabilize the TV scale, and then we would find the Higgs within SUSY, and that is completely wrong, obviously. So here, this is just from the ATLAS and CMS results from run one. I want to say that we have discovered the Higgs, and you have seen it in the diphoton, in 2Z and 2Ws. We have bigger errors in the channels with Bs and Taus and other channels here. But the discovery was on the bosonic sector, specifically. Diphoton and diboson, di z and 2z and 2w, zz and ww. Now I want to go back a little bit in history and remind people that the idea of electroweak symmetry breaking, or the idea of any symmetry breaking that brings complexity, and is a notion that we study and we learned. Particle physicists learn from condensed matter physicists. In fact, it is called the Higgs-Anderson mechanism. And this was pointed out by Nam Bu in 1960 when he gave the talk for his Nobel Prize on the importance of spontaneous symmetry breaking. And his Nobel lecture was spontaneous symmetry breaking in particle physics, a case of cross-fertilization, where he explained that in real material systems, ferromagnets, crystal, and superconductors, you have a broken symmetry, and it is expressed with some complexity after the symmetry is broken. So in ferromagnets, it's rotational invariance that is broken, and then you have spin waves. In crystals, you have translational and rotational invariance, and you've got phonons. In superconductors, you have some local gauge invariance, which is the particle number, and you have Cooper pairs of what we call heavy photon. All of these are material systems, and today, people are in condensed matter, they are working in different quantum phases of matter and different kinds of symmetry breakings that create states. They create so-called, it's not Higgs, the quantum vacuum breaking, but it is different kinds of states that have to do with condensed matter. One is the example that I have here, which was, I think, from an article in Physics Today. So in particle colliders, we have the Higgs. In superconductors, the energy scale of what is the jiggling state when there is a symmetry breaking. These are the Cooper pairs. There is in Bose-Einstein condenses and antiferromagnets and so on. And so, in fact, just recently we hired somebody at Caltech that has Higgs superfluids and Monte-insulator transition, and this is like a 300 hertz type of state that it is a Higgs. So now for the Higgs at the LHC, the significant effort is to characterize the properties of the Higgs, to observe the Higgs in as many channels as possible. I told you we observed it only in the bosonic sector. This is electroweak symmetry breaking, how the Ws and Zs are getting their mass. The fermion sector is much, 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 much more difficult. It's connected through what we call the Yukawa couplings that are proportional to the mass of the particles, and the interaction with the Higgs is important there. We check the coupling structure of the standard model, a long program. Any deviation of the Higgs couplings would indicate new physics. And just to say that the mass of the particle of the Higgs boson has been measured to 0.2% precision, and this is its value, 125 GeV. Now, the angular distribution in terms of its spin, it's spin zero, and all couplings so far that we have measured within some large number here of some confidence limit, 2.5 sigma, so we need to get more precise about that, are consistent nonetheless with the standard model. I will remind you how we discovered them and how we rediscovered them, both at Atlas and CMS. This is the CMS Higgs to gamma-gamma channel. This little blip is the Higgs. And you can see the blip bigger when you subtract this background, which is data-driven estimated. And this is the Higgs in the ZZ, where you have four leptons. And if you take their invariant mass, it gives you the Higgs at 125. There's an internal candle here that you can cross-check your energy scales, and it has to do with the mass of the Z, as you see. And then the same plot and the same we presented in 2016 from Atlas, their blip and their four leptons. Very compatible results. It's important when we have this type of experiments and discoveries to have reproducibility. This is why we have two experiments. Now, the couplings are important because this is the whole gauge structure of the standard model and how the particles, how the story about the Higgs and the particles acquiring mass is developed. We have this type of measurement so far. This is from CMS and similar from Atlas for the different particles. The W's and the Z's are the most precisely determined because this is, we have the more than 5 sigma discovery there. We have enough data. And then we've got the different couplings, top, bottom, tau, and muon, very huge. And the confidence level, when I said that they are within 2 sigma, that's what it means. Now, this is with this amount of data at 8 TeV, and also the RAN 0, which was a little bit of data at 7 TeV. Now, if we do in our TDR for how we are going to evolve this program in the next 10 years, we are making studies at 14 TeV, 3,000 inverse femtobarn. And people can make bets here if we're going to be at 14 TeV or at 18 TeV or at 30 TeV in 10 years from now. I would prefer to be at 30 TeV. And but this is what we have at hand right now and what we are preparing. And these are the coupling. These are the extrapolation, how the projection on how we are going to be measuring these couplings. This is very significant because any deviations from these is going to tell us whether there is some new physics. Now, before I show you this, because the people who are doing the precision Higgs measurements for a linear collider, that would be a Higgs factory, they have studied this very well. This would be their object. This is the raison d'etre for them, the existential reason to build such a machine. But before I show you this, let me show you from Atlas. What a daunting environment that is when we go in 10 years from now to measure these at this accuracy and go from the 20% to the percent level. It's a totally daunting environment with over 200 interactions per crossing. We call this pileup because we don't have just the one hard scattering. The way we bunch the beams and the way we put the number of protons we put, we get extra interactions for the same crossing that are being reconstructed in the same event. And, of course, these things, first of all, you can imagine that they nuke our detector. This is what the candle was there for, in my opinion. So there is a lot of radiation damage that has to do with these interactions. This is the so-called pileup, and then we have to figure out how to trigger the data acquisition and also associated with this, how we deal with this big data and computing, how we store all this, how we reconstruct all this. It's not an easy, it's a daunting task. Going back to the measurement of the couplings, the ILC people, and this is the International Linear Collider people who are preparing a study in Japan for a machine that could be 500 GV, and here they have also a 250 GV to 500 GV that could be at the center of mass that could be even go to the 800 GV, but they don't show that. This is projections. If we had additional high degrees of freedom that are supersymmetric degrees of freedom, then you would have deviations from the standard model at these levels for these particular couplings. In fact, you see that for the Z and the W, you can't see much for SUSY. So you would have to have a very good measurement of the B, the top, and heavy flavor and top in general, and tau in general. However, for a composite Higgs model, and that means that the Higgs is not elementary, we didn't address this on what I said before, but what I mentioned at the very beginning is that we have one and only one elementary scalar, and that's the Higgs. And we think the elementary is important. We think it's elementary, but we haven't proven it, that it is elementary. And the way to prove it is to do these measurements, because if we have deviations from these measurements, it could mean that, in fact, it's a composite. We have very good reasons to believe that it is elementary, but this would show you that, in fact, something else is going on, and that the Higgs is, for example, like a pion or like some bound state. Now, all of this, in order to be done, requires a program that you understand very well all your corrections, the QCD corrections, the electroweak corrections, and also the PDF uncertainties, the composition of the protons. And so this is a very long and painstaking program that one is undertaking to do this. So now I will, in the last 10 minutes, I will talk a little bit about the curveballs that the Higgs has thrown us into, and specifically the one that has to do with the mass of the Higgs. So the mass of the Higgs, we measure it, and I showed you the most recent measurement at 125 GeV. And 125 GeV Higgs, if you assume that there is nothing else, no other degrees of freedom, and that it is valid, that the standard model with only the one Higgs is valid at all scales up to the Planck, then that mass is at what is called the edge of the stability of the electroweak vacuum. And I will explain in 1 minute what this means, but this is extremely weird that it is at that edge of the stability. In order to get out of this edge of stability, here you are unstable, for example. I should have made this, one is metastable, one is a stable. This should have been two different colors. But the Higgs is coming exactly at the point that it is metastable. People have calculated with the quantum field theory we trust up to the Planck scale that this could happen at 10 to the 111 years, where our electroweak vacuum will roll, it will turn around, and then our universe will bubble out to some other universe of a lower vacuum value. Okay, if you believe that the Higgs is 125, and you believe in the Suzy extensions, which is what we believed because we thought that this is the most elegant mathematically and practically, given all the data that we have, way of stabilizing the Higgs, then you are still at some boundary here between the vanilla Suzy that we have envisioned and made our benchmarks, and then Suzy extensions, where you start to put more Higgses, extra this, extra. You start putting by hand things in order to get the mass higher. And then for composite Higgs, this is a little unfair, I should say, but it still doesn't. It seems to be in some boundary where it doesn't make sense to have heavy dynamics in composite Higgs. So this is a curveball, just by means of the mass of the Higgs. If the Higgs was just a little lighter, we would have had a different kind of discussion. Or a bit more heavy, for that matter. So this type of observation and the program that we are carrying right now, including the program for the measurement of the self-coupling, and I will come to that because it has to do with the instability of the universe, is the thing that is creating the status of affairs that is creating all these questions. In other words, does the Higgs destabilize the electroweak vacuum? How does the electroweak scale emerge? Why is this the electroweak scale? Is there a Higgs portal to dark matter? We said that the Higgs should be connected with everything that has mass. We said that it's a question mark. How is it connected to the neutrinos? But if dark matter is some sort of a particle, whether it is Suzy or something else, if it is a particle of a field that can be described in a quantum field theoretical way, then how is it connected to that? And there is now a huge program on this type of Higgs portal analysis at the LHC. And of course, there are some more questions is the Higgs sector responsible for the genesis of matter in the early universe? This is the given the fact that BICEP has not, in fact, seen primordial gravitational waves because they were wrong about the dust, the first cosmic event that we have from the universe is the electroweak phase transition, which is the time that we went from a massless universe to a massive universe. And so this is an interesting, it's interesting to figure out whether indeed the what we call baryogenesis or the genesis of matter, what I say here, is this really the Higgs sector responsible for that? And then we talked about that, how the Higgs talks to the neutrinos, and of course, is the Higgs related to inflation or dark energy? How the Higgs is connected, in other words, with the since we say it's the vacuum, if we calculate the vacuum and compare it to what we observe from cosmology, we get 10 to the 120 difference in this calculation. This is a gross difference. If you put supersymmetry, you get the difference that it is 10 to the 30 or 40. This is a gross difference still. So what is going on here? How is the vacuum, the Higgs vacuum, connected to inflation, to the energy that you create for every square centimeter at the edge of the universe as the universe accelerates and creates space-time at the edge of the universe? So this is questions that somehow one might think that they are related. And these type of questions motivate a precision program, a discovery program, and an observation program. Very quickly, I will show you the quantum vacuum instability. And it has to do with the potential, you know, the Mexican hot potential, how it is. If you start changing in the energy versus Higgs field strength, the lambda of the, and we are here at the vacuum here, then you can change the potential of the Higgs to turn around. So the sombrero, you know it, is like that. But if you, this lambda, the quartic self-interaction, the strength of this interaction is also depending on how you extrapolate in a quantum field theory way and you put corrections from the quantum loops. So there is a possibility that this actual potential, it doesn't go like that and you are at the lowest point, but it turns around. Your rim of your hat turns around, and then you fall. And this is what we called the metastability. This is shown by in the Higgs versus top mass, and this is extremely important. Then immediately you understand why it is extremely important to have a very precise measurement of the top mass and the Higgs mass. And we do have a very precise measurement of the top mass from CDF, but we need to see also the top mass at the LHC and figure out in which region we are in this plot. This plot is not valid if I assume new physics. Now, there is some speculations here in this slide, but this is just for the sake of keeping our heads a little bit open. If you go back to the calculation of Coleman and Weinberg, this is not Steven Weinberg, but Lee Weinberg, they presented a possibility that, in fact, the electroweak symmetry breaking is generated by some radiative instability. And so the electroweak scale is generated by what they call by what they call dimensional transmutation, and it's exactly the same thing that creates the QCD scale, but with weak coupling. Now, people have made models where all mass scales are generated with this kind of dimensional transmutation, specifically Bardeen and others, by adding some additional scalar. And people are doing this because there's something extremely appealing about the idea that all mass is a quantum phenomenon. Now, the Planck scale, which is Newton's gravitational constant, somehow must be also generated, if you go along this line of thinking, must be generating also as a quantum effect. And so this is the so-called ideas where now you say that gravity, maybe not fundamental, and it's emergent, it's an emergent phenomenon, and it's emergent from the quantum. In that case, perhaps grand unification is wrong, and the question is, from all this line of thinking that started from how we connect the Higgs, the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, the Higgs with the Planck scale, in the way we know how to calculate, maybe that we have to think other ways to experimentally test this type of ideas. Now, I mentioned a little bit on the Higgs portal, and in the Bardeen case, for example, this extrascalar, or the dimensional transmutation extrascalar, this is theoretical, but the thing to take home is that this could couple to lighter dark fermions or scalars or heavier dark gauge bosons that could be the dark matter. And I will say a word about this in a bit, because there is many graduate students who are here doing thesis and analysis on the dark sector with dark photons and dark forces. Since the weak scale paradigm of dark matter and SUSY is getting assaulted really from all corners experimentally, we are gearing our experimental program to figure out at lower mass scales whether we have something and whether the mediator is in a hidden sector. And the theorists are very good in preparing such models. So we do have many models right now to address the problem that we haven't found the WIMP in the electroweak scale. So the classical way of thinking of how the dark matter interacts with baryonic matter in it's a, the dark matter is weakly coupled, and the Z boson is the electroweak boson, weak coupling, so maybe the interaction is mediated in the standard model with the Z. We know for sure, that is the only thing we know for sure, is that with gravity, this is how we detected the dark matter. And the question is super weakly, it could be via the Higgs boson. And this is the kind of work that we are trying to do in the different analysis at the LHC. Some of these analyses that are the analyses that they are tagging the Higgs, and then they have the Higgs is decaying invisibly. I'm not going to go into these details. And we present these results in a form that it is in the usual form of high energy physicists present data, observations, Monte Carlo, and difference, and then you don't see any excess anywhere, and you say, no, I didn't find it. And now I am going to skip a little bit. Actually, let me just say one word, because it has to do again with an excursion from the data from what we expect from the standard model is in this lepton flavor violating Higgs decays, namely the Higgs decaying to mu tau, and these are instead of mu mu, which would be the flavor conserving, so it's of different flavors, leptons of different flavors, and we had seen in the early run of 8TV, you see. This is the expectation. This is the data. We see a little excess. It's not a huge excess, but we had to follow up with this, and we don't see it in the e-tau, but we see it also in the 13TV. But you see the errors here. The shaded is the error, and the errors here are very big, so we cannot say anything. But in the Morion data set, this is only a part of the 13TV. Data. In the Morion data set, we will have the answers for this kind of small deviations that we have. Another such small deviation, which is interesting, I showed you in the plot of the instability of the vacuum, the top with the Higgs. And now here is one channel with TT bar Higgs, where of course you have the coupling of the top with the Higgs directly in this. And so this is showing a little bit of a deviation, which we need to explore what is happening there. And any time that you hear about something that has Higgs and top in the final state and deviation, remember the quantum vacuum instability that we have and the plot with the top and the Higgs, that they have to do something, and we need to get to the bottom of this. Other small deviations exist. So to close in the last few minutes, the big story of the LHC is, of course, supersymmetry in its absence, that we haven't seen it. And this is from the ATLAS experiment. There is over 100 analysis in many different channels, and almost 500 papers or more that we have produced where supersymmetry does not show to be there, not at the 8 TV-run and not at the 13 TV-run. In the old days, if we had not found the Higgs, we could have speculated on what is going on. Today, however, the Higgs, we have found it. And so all the story that we need the SUSY in order to stabilize the Higgs, as I started this talk, all this becomes a little bit inconsistent or fishy. How do we say that we need heavier degrees of freedom to stabilize the Higgs? The Higgs is there. So maybe something there we need to change the thinking. And this was the conclusion also from all the natural searches, because people looked at different kinds of regions of stealth SUSY with different kind of hierarchies in the mass, and maybe because it's whispering to us, the signal is very faint, or it's very much looking like the standard model. And we looked at all these areas. In fact, this is from CMS, but ATLAS has an even better result, that we have covered all possible areas specifically for the most natural solutions for SUSY with stops and bottoms at the electroweak scale, and we are excluding one after the other. Just let me tell you that the limits on the stop is at 910 GeV from the 2017 of 760. So this is one TV, close to one TV, and the Gluino was 1800 GV. Just to give you a sense, when I did my thesis, I excluded something like 350 GV Gluino, and Gordy Kane was crying because he said, SUSY is over. You have excluded SUSY. Of course, with different kind of model building and corrections, we figured out that we can have SUSY at the TV. But now we are asking for it. There is an issue here. Now I will... SUSY was giving us the dark matter particle, and I said that SUSY per se, as fixing the Higgs problem, is under assault. And so is the dark matter, the weak scale paradigm for dark matter. And here are all the direct dark matter experiments that are being producing results all over the world. Where here is the dark matter nucleon cross section as a function of the dark matter mass. And this is 1 GV, and this is the experiments go all the way to 10 to the 4. And we see that the cross-section is from weak up here, 10 to the minus 39, 10 to the minus 32, to super weak, very low cross-section. And the mediator, when I showed you the diagram before, if dark matter was coming through interactions with the Z boson, we would have seen it here, and that has been ruled out. And if it is through the Higgs, we are arriving to this area. These are the area of supersymmetric models where if the dark matter is the candidate, we would just find it. It would be next. It would be just around the corner that either direct dark matter or the LHC will discover something in these areas here of masses above 100 and below 1,000. Now, this is a floor where below this floor you are going to have to do neutrino physics because you are having an irreducible background in these dark matter experiments. But the name of the game appears that when this program is finished and we haven't found a dark matter particle in this range, then we have to go and look all these hidden sectors. Then we have to go lower than the 1 GV, check which models are giving us which... It may seem that we make work, but unless we look and we broaden the search, we're never going to know if it is really at the milli-EV scale or at the EV scale. So this is what theorists have been doing in the past years. This has permeated the experimental world, both in the collider searches and in the direct dark matter searches. And I have only two slides where I want to show you. This is the traditional, this is from Catherine Zurek, who has been working on dark matter since forever. And she's a high-energy theorist that is now calculating interactions of a low-mass dark matter all the way down here. This is many or 10 to the minus 9 of what we are looking here. And calculating which kind of target, what kind of materials we should have in order to be able to see not any more nucleon WIMP cross-section and interaction, but electronic scattering from electron scattering. So she's coming into, with colleagues, of course, she's coming into solutions of which kind of designer materials we could use in order to go from the 100 GeV, where we have the traditional WIMP searches with xenon and LZ, down to semiconductors with super CDMS, down to superconductors and edge transition sensors, down to here in these areas with graphene and superfluid helium, all the way down to one milliV, and from 1 kV, 1 eV, 1 milliV. So very many orders of magnitudes to cover this space. This could be a 5-year or 10-year program, and you see that here there is all these studies that one could do with graphene, for example. There was an experiment that was designed to detect the relic cosmic neutrinos, but they thought that with graphene they can make it into a directional dark matter experiment. And the reason for all these designer materials is that because according to the gap they have, the energy gap, you can see different kind of interactions, and you can detect the faintest signals with this kind of dark matter particles. So new ideas for dark matter detection are on the way. They are moving beyond the nuclear recoils, and they require new phases of matter, and this is crucial in order to access all this spectrum. And the materials are essential to have diverse materials. They are studying graphene, superconductor, semiconductor, helium, and even these new types of materials that they are the vile semi-metals. And for this, there is a fun interplay with condensed matter physics. In fact, there is a sub-EV workshop on dark matter, and you see the telescopes here. People who are building this type of devices, they are very much in all the frontiers that I talked to you about. People who are doing one photon detectors, they can be cosmologists and astronomers and particle physicists. So there is some consilience there and some synergies among all these areas. So let me finish by saying, where is the beyond the standard model? Where is the shot in the dark that we are taking? And in fact, the answer is it's everywhere. There is actually dark matter. There is dark energy. We think there is inflation. There is for sure baryogenesis, because this is the universe we live in. There is for sure neutrino masses. So there is a lot of beyond the standard model physics that we have around us. We are missing, obviously, something. So what are we missing? I don't know what we're missing. I don't know which clues and thoughts and paradigm shifts we're missing, but I think that the way to move is to study exhaustively the Higgs and the neutrinos properties. These are the two new sectors, two new particles, categories of particles that we have at our hands, is to search for dark matter everywhere, keeping in mind that maybe it's not a particle, but unless we search it everywhere, we will not know, and then look for connecting principles. Thank you.